Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Brigadier General John Ferrari, Director of Program Analysis and Evaluation within the Office of the U.S. Army's Deputy Chief of Staff. General, the Army is fundamentally changing the organization and management of its structure and forces. Would you tell us more about the Army's efforts around generating force readiness with such initiatives as the Army Contingency Force and the Regionally Aligning Forces Initiative? Why are these being pursued, and what's the status of each?
Right. So those are two very good examples of how you manage a complex world with a complex budget situation. So we have a responsibility to provide so many forces in case of an unplanned large-scale contingency operation. But because we talked about that of our 20% budget reduction, we actually don't have the money to keep all those forces ready at this time. So what we had to decide to do was, well, do you give a little bit of money to a lot of forces and then they're trained maybe half of what they need, or do you focus the resources and train a smaller pool so that at least you have a smaller set of the force ready to go? And that's where the contingency force comes in, right? So that's our answer to not having enough training dollars to train what the defense strategy tells us has to be ready to go. And the chief of staff of the Army has recently, you know, we'd like to have 70% of our forces ready to go to meet contingency ops. But we can only afford right now, for a variety of reasons, to we've only got about 30%. So that 30% is pooled, if you will, into what we call the contingency force. So they know that if something happens, they're the first to go. And what we hope is then that, and hope is not a method, but it's what we have, that A, either the contingency will be of duration and nature that that force can accomplish the mission, or B, we have enough time and resources get put in to train the rest of the force, or C, which is what we don't want, we have to deploy the rest of the force with less than optimal training levels. So that's the contingency force. Mm-hmm. The regionally aligned force is the answer to how do you deal with all of these dispersed missions in small unit sets, right? So that's the plan, right? That's how you deal with the day-to-day operations. So what we've done is we've taken parts of the Army and we've said, okay, for the next couple of years, you're going to focus on Iraq and you're going to rotate back and forth in units. And so we've kind of taken the Army and kind of instead of saying, okay, because the last couple of years, as we said, okay, everybody, it's Iraq or Afghanistan. And that's what we've been focused on. So now we've got forces that are kind of focused on Europe, some forces on Africa, some forces on Afghanistan, some on Iraq, some in the Pacific. And so we're trying to divide the world up to allow a degree of specialization of those forces. And then we enable the combatant commander who's conducting the operations in the region to kind of tailor those forces for what they need. And we think it'll provide a degree of flexibility and predictability to the combatant commander and to the forces as we try to adapt to this new environment of kind of brush fires popping up all over the place.
General, you're doing another comprehensive restructuring. That's around your aviation portfolio. I thought you and your team did a wonderful job at the Center for Strategic International Studies explaining how complicated this effort is. Could you tell us a little bit more about what you're doing with the Army Aviation Portfolio?
Right. So the Aviation Portfolio is one of the largest capabilities the Army has in terms of resources. And as we lost 20% of our budget, they were not immune. And they had a lot of modernization that had – we had grown it during the war. So we had gone from 10 combat aviation battalions in the regular Army, in the active force, to 13 to meet the demand. Well, now we were going from 570,000 people down to 450. So they had to shrink also. So they had to lose manpower, and they were losing modernization dollars. Well, they had 7 aircraft that they had to maintain and sustain. So the decision was made, well, first off, we've got to get smaller. So you can't afford 13 units of manpower. You're only going to have 10. And you can't afford to modernize everything. So the decision was to do some very clean divestitures. So we got rid of 3 of our types of aircraft, the oldest types that we have had since Vietnam. And that enabled us then to take what was left of the modernization dollars and put them into the most modern capable aircraft we have. And what we wanted to make sure that the smaller force was more capable. Because if the smaller force was less capable and you were smaller and less capable, that's a recipe for disaster. So we integrated unmanned aerial systems into So we have now have manned, unmanned teaming. So that's a way to get capability without needing more people, right, into the fight. We focused on modernization and sustainment dollars. When you get rid of an entire aircraft, the entire logistics system with it goes. And so you wind up saving a lot of money and resources. And so what we then now have is 10 combat aviation brigades in the active component. And then in the reserve component, they'll have a similar structure but without the attack helicopters because those are the most expensive platforms we have. And we really couldn't afford to buy enough, so we're putting them in the regular Army.
You may have touched on it, but what are some of the key challenges faced with doing what you've done to the aviation portfolio?
So the challenges are when you have a portfolio and a structure that's been put in place over the course of a decade, right, that's a lot of change. And it goes back to leading change and change management. You've got to change all of the acquisition programs, the ones you had and the ones that you're going to do to support that. And so anyone involved with defense acquisition knows that it's very difficult to make changes there. And so we had to do that. We had to change all of the resourcing and the dollars within those accounts. And so that's very difficult to do and took a couple of years. We had to change the mix between what was in the reserve component and what was in the active force. And that's difficult to do because, right, the Congress is involved in that mix because they are the ones who ultimately decide how we organize, train, and equip. And then we had to change the way we train pilots, which is fundamentally. We had been training pilots the same way in the Army since the Vietnam War. And so when we couldn't afford to replace or upgrade the trainer we had, we went with a more modern aircraft, but it really fundamentally changes the way you train pilots. And I'm not a pilot, so I didn't make the decisions, but it is a very big cultural change. So you had to change the way you train people. You had to change the way you organize people. You had to change the way you station the force. We're changing the way we rotate the force into theater. We change the way we acquire and which systems we're acquiring, and we're changing the mix between the active, the guard, and reserve. So what you have to do is be able to gain consensus and sell the concept that everybody has to suboptimize in order to get the most optimal combination of resources, acquisition, mix, and manpower to get the most capability we can get out of it.
Interesting way to put it, very clear. I mean, you know, you mentioned training, and I'd like to switch to a more general focus on training. For the last 11 years or so, units have been training around counterinsurgency operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. How has the Army updated its training strategy going forward? And more particularly, what is required to restore training readiness?
It's really about developing leaders who understand how to train. And what we've had, because of the war, the counterinsurgency war lasted so long, over a decade, is we focused all of our training and leader development on the war we were in. We had been focused, though, on a very local, decentralized fight. So what we've got to do now is make up for a generation of lost leaders who don't even know what right looks like, not because there's anything wrong with them, it's because we never taught them that. And so it takes time to do that. And so in the Army, what we're focusing on is using the combat training centers to do that. That's our premier training event for doing that. Now, over the past 10 years, we turned our combat training centers into mission rehearsal centers where you'd train just for whatever mission you were going to do. We've now put them back to preparing people for the broad spectrum of warfare. But what we find is when you take a unit that hasn't done that and you send them in there the first time, right, they'll do well, but they're still learning what right looks like. You've got to take the organization and the leaders and run it through it over a period of time in years. You got to get a couple of rotations so that the company commander, right, that young captain who goes through there as a company commander, he learns what it's like to be a company commander. And then when he comes back the next time as, let's say, the operations officer for the battalion over that, he now knows what's going to happen and he can train those company commanders. The fiscal uncertainty comes in. It goes back to we've had to concentrate our training resources for those rotations at the expense of preparing to go to the rotations. So the units don't necessarily have all the time and money they need to prepare for it. So they're going to those rotations, learning how to do that warfare, but coming in not at the level we might have hoped for had we had enough money so that they could have done the train up and come in just a little bit better, and then you come out a lot more better.
Yeah, and so I was wondering, properly equipping your troops is essential. And I want to know if you could tell us a little bit more about the decision to continue investment in the science and technology area, and perhaps you could share the underlying rationale and the implications of pursuing incremental improvements of rather than procuring new systems.
Right. So in the Army, we have the way I view modernization is really in three bins, right? So the first is science and technology. The second is incremental upgrades. And the third is new development. So let's start with science and technology, right? So that's the investments you make for capabilities that you'll see 2 decades from now. You can't predict invention. You just can't. I mean, it will come at its own pace. You can try to accelerate it through increased resources. But what we do know is if you don't make the investment, then the invention won't happen. So what the secretary and the chief decided was to protect the money in the science and technology because they owed that not even to the soldiers of next decade, but to the soldiers the decade after that. Because once you stop doing that, there's no recovery from that. Now, within the science and technology, now we protected it. We're not taking money out, but we're not adding money. Mm-hmm. We had to focus it. And so we look at technology simply as there are places we are technology makers, and there are places where we are technology takers. So we're trying to reduce funding where we are technology takers, where other people in the world are working on things. So information technology is a great area, right? There's a lot of money being spent around the world on information technology. So if we spend a little bit less, that technology will continue to evolve. Maybe not in the exact direction we want or at the pace, but it'll still move forward. But there are a lot of technologies where we are technology makers. Munitions, gun technology, survivability like armor, interesting enough, aviation rotorcraft, where if we as the Army don't invest, nobody else is investing. And so 10, 15, 20 years from now, we'll be where we are today. So we decided to protect that. But we had to take money from somewhere. So the choice then we were left with is, do you take it out of incremental improvement, which takes what you have today and in the near term makes it better? Or do you take risk in that area and instead invest in new development, new weapon systems that come online next decade in the 20s? So we decided to protect that incremental upgrade. Well, what that meant then was almost the full force of the reduction to modernization, which was disproportionate because we didn't get the manpower we talked about, is going to fall on new development. And so where we as an Army have taken risk and we had to cancel most of the development of new systems that will come online in the 2025 period.
What is the U.S. Army doing to change the way it operates? We will ask Brigadier General John Ferrari, Director of Program Analysis and Evaluation within the Office of the U.S. Army's Deputy Chief of Staff, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.